This is the Reality Radio Network on Telstar 5 Transponder 5 and on the internet at realityradionetwork.com.
You can see it in the movies and the paper and the TV news. Somebody's army is always on the move. There's gonna be a battle, the lines have been drawn. They got guns and tanks and planes. The wells are gone dry and the water is bad, and the air is acid rain. There's war after war and rumors of war from the east. There's a rumbling in the ground and they're talking about the beast. Good mother's cry calls, the rivers run high with the blood of too many sons. Some people say peace is on the way, but the worst is still to come. Cause the prophets wrote about it and Jesus spoke about it and John got to take a look. And he told us what he saw and it's easy to see. It's going by the book. It's going by the book.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's going by the book. Welcome to this Passover Thursday edition of the Q-Files. This is Tom Horn filling in once again for Stephen Quayle, and tonight we're going to do something a little bit different in that I have invited the guest that I love the most to join me for this special Easter edition of the Q-Files. The guest I love the most, of course, could only be one person, and that's my lovely wife, Nita. Are you there, babe?
I am.
Well, I want you to know something, I promise. You are the only guest that you're ever going to hear me say, "Are you there, babe?" I'm sure not going to say it to Stephen Quayle. Listen, folks, I've invited my wife, Nita, to join me tonight because as I was thinking earlier this week about this week and what it means to a lot of people, realized that it's one of the most important holy times to many Christians and controversial to other Christians, that this would be a perfect opportunity to look at the history of Easter and to talk tonight about what it should or shouldn't mean to us as believers. Leading into this week, I was looking for a news story that I might use to intro this whole idea of a discussion about the history of Easter. And the problem was, it was a staggering number of headlines that could have been used to launch this discussion. You might have seen this week where now we're being told that Jesus did not walk on water. Did you hear that? That's right. They say that the lake was frozen. The sea was frozen. Jesus was walking on ice. And so I guess that means that the disciples were sitting out there in some kind of an ice-breaking ship, or they were frozen in place, and Jesus had to just go slipping, sliding out there across the ice to get to them. It's amazing what you learn in the news, huh? We also learned this week that Judas was a hero. We also learned this week that prayer doesn't work, and therefore you might as well not even try. In fact, according to that particular study, they said you might even get worse if you pray. Any of those stories could have been used to launch a discussion of Easter and what it does or doesn't mean to us today. In fact, folks, did you see the headline this week about a giant monster rabbit that's devouring English veggie gardens? I mean, this is hilarious. It's a story that's just is reminiscent of this last Wallace and Gromit movie, Beware of the Were-Rabbit. I mean, furious villagers in northeast England have hired armed guards to protect their beloved communal vegetable gardens from a suspected monster, a were-rabbit. We didn't even know the thing really existed. I thought it was just a cartoon. This thing's cutting a swath through their greens, and so they've had to hired assassins to bring down the were-rabbit. A science and technology story that I could have used this week has to do with a European spacecraft called the Venus Express. It went into orbit just Tuesday of this week around Venus, on a mission to explore the mysterious atmosphere of Earth's nearest planetary neighbor, while today it started sending back its first pictures of the South Pole of Venus. The space agency is saying they're going to use this spacecraft's instruments to search for clues as to why Venus wound up with an atmosphere that's almost 90 times denser than Earth's, shrouded in clouds of sulfuric acid, and other questions that they want to answer, since Venus, according to our best minds, formed at about the same time that the Earth formed and in much the same way, so why did it turn out so much different than we are? More importantly, what does this have to do with Easter? Well, ask yourself this question. Why was this probe designed to reach Venus on Easter week and to begin sending back photos beginning on Passover Thursday? Is it because in late Babylonian astrology, the goddess Ishtar, which some people say is actually pronounced Easter, was related to the planet Venus? That's right. Most prominent deity in the late Babylonian pantheon was equated by the Greeks with Aphrodite or Venus. Those tricky people that get this funding, they're always playing these little mind games with us. That story, of course, could have also been used. But in the end, I decided on the Script Howard News Service story that came out a few days ago that said that most Americans now reject the idea of the resurrection of the dead. In fact, only 36%, and this includes among Christians, in this most recent poll say they believed that they might be resurrected at some point in the future. Two-thirds don't even believe it. Well, we're going to talk about it, but before we get to that, I understand that my gorgeous wife, Nita, has prepared some basic questions that we're going to use to guide this holiday season of Easter show. She wants to use these as kind of a guideline. And I've told her that I'll just respond the best way I can. I'll do the best job I can. And but she's going to guide the show tonight, so it's kind of a turn of events. I'm actually being interviewed. Babe, anytime you're ready, I'm ready.
Well, I appreciate this opportunity to ask questions of you. I was kind of hoping that maybe we could start out by having you explain the history of Easter. You know, there are so many images associated with Easter, and while you're talking about the resurrection of Christ, most people are shopping for frilly little dresses, Easter bonnets, candy baskets, and many of the churches are planning to host neighborhood Easter egg hunts. But what does all of this have to do with Christ and the resurrection? I mean, is it good? Is it bad? Is it indifferent? What is your opinion?
Well, I mean, of course, you know, like so many of the other religious festivals or holy days, it's possible that a variety of things happen down through time to create confusion as to the origin of this particular holy day or as to what this day, if anything, should mean to us today. The simple answer as to where Easter derived its importance to modern Christianity is, of course, that the Christian festival of Easter is supposed to be a celebration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Actually, it has some of its roots in the Jewish Passover, which commemorated Israel's deliverance from the bondage of Egypt. But the Christian reinterpretation of that festival is the crucifixion of Jesus during the Passover, and then the proclamation of his resurrection 3 days later. Now that's the pat answer, that's the patented answer. That's the answer that I gave when I was pastoring for 25 years and had to get up on, you know, Sunday of this week and preach a message about Easter. But where it starts getting tricky is where the history of Easter and the way we celebrate it today turns up in the minds of, you know, some people like the 8th century English monk Venerable Bede, who believed that Easter was actually derived from Estra, the old Germanic goddess of spring. And others, by the way, have reached similar conclusions, that Easter began either with Ostara, or began with Ishtar, the Assyrian fertility goddess of spring, or Astarte, which was a Phoenician and Greek composite of Ishtar and Aphrodite. That answer your question?
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned these fertility goddesses, Ostara, Astarte, and Aphrodite, Ishtar. Is this where the things like the Easter egg originated?
Yeah. Well, in many people's opinion, yes. I mean, the fact that many of these pagans used rabbits and so-called Easter eggs as fertility symbols to celebrate the forces of spring. And the fact that these forces were usually manifested in the popular goddess images is understandable. It fits with mythology, the whole idea that the changing of the seasons, you know, it kind of represented something to people that didn't quite understand it, but they saw it as life, and they associated it with what they did know, mother images who had the capacity for giving life. And that's, by the way, that's why in 1966, a guy by the name of Ralph Woodrow wrote a little book called Babylon Mystery Religion, in which he was complaining that Easter was therefore an adaptation of the pagan spring festivals into the church. And he, you know, he was furious about it. He thought it added pagan customs to the worship of the true God, and therefore he thought that whole idea was absolutely contemptible.
But a lot of people disagree with Woodrow's opinion, right?
Right. Well, sure, obviously. In fact, I was reading an article not too long ago about the recently converted Worldwide Church of God. And they were talking about some of this stuff, and they disagreed. I mean, the whole point of their position was that even if the word Easter was associated with ancient goddesses, that it didn't mean that to moderns today. And this whole article was how different English language words are connected with different ancient gods. If, for instance, the word cereal that we use comes from the name of an ancient goddess of agriculture called Ceres. But the point they were making is that, well, you know, when we use the word cereal today, we're not thinking about goddesses. We don't go to the breakfast table to worship a goddess. I mean, we're thinking Frosted Flakes. We're thinking granola. And so they take that argument a step further and say that, you know, kids who are hunting Easter eggs are probably not doing it in adoration of Ishtar.
And yet, isn't this a sticky subject? I mean, what were these fertility rites about? And how did they become part of the celebration of the resurrection of Christ?
How did these fertility rites get confused with the celebration of the resurrection of Christ? Well, once again, you know, there's a substantial amount of history. And so let's just get into it. There's no way in the world that we can cover all of this in a one-hour show, but we do the best we can. Kind of the abbreviated answer, I guess, would have to do with how the worship of Ishtar or Astarte or Astara or some of these other goddesses who were associated with fertility, how that belief system had spread throughout Europe. And in Europe, of course, among the Germanic peoples, it became known as Astara, the Anglo-Saxon goddess of spring and fertility and the rising sun and so on. But sacred to Astara was what was called the vibrant moon hare. This rabbits come out at night to feed at night. And so this vibrant moon hare, according to this mythology, laid these golden eggs of the sun, and these golden eggs would hatch and provide life. And this happened during spring and Easter time. And the moon hare with its life-giving eggs, over a period of time, you know, started turning up in shop windows and store windows. And today you think of it as the Easter Bunny. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but the name Estra, which is taken from Ostara, Estra, gives rise to the name of the female hormone estrogen. Which obviously plays a role in human fertility.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, you have this spread of this whole belief system, pagan fertility goddesses, Ishtar, Astarte, Aphrodite, finally Ostara, by the people who migrated into southern Britain. Then, around the 2nd century A.D., Christian missionaries that were seeking to convert the people that lived in northern Europe, they made a discovery. They started realizing that the time that they were celebrating the crucifixion of Jesus Christ roughly coincided with the Teutonic springtime celebrations. Volstara, which all of this, of course, was emphasizing the triumph of life over death. And so these missionaries decided that it would be best if they integrated their religious ideas into the story of Christ, those of the pagan goddesses. They thought that that would make it easier to get the heathens to convert to Christianity. As a matter of fact, Venerable Beattie, who I referred to earlier, he was, he was quite a historian, and he wrote a very important piece of historical literature called The Ecclesiastic History of the English People. And anybody, I think, can get that and read it. But it, interestingly, in that volume, it contains a letter from Pope Gregory to St. Mellitus, who at the time was on his way to England to conduct missionary work among the Anglo-Saxons. And in that letter, the Pope actually suggests that converting heathens is easier if they're allowed to retain the outward forms of their traditional practices and traditions, while recasting those traditions spiritually or inwardly toward Christianity instead of to their indigenous gods. An interesting thing in that letter that's contained in the Ecclesiastic History of the English People is that the Pope actually refers to their pagan deities as devils. He actually says they are devils. But he says, to that end, while some gratification, meaning allowing them to continue to recognize some of the outward parts of their practices, he says, while some gratification is outwardly permitted them, they may the more easily consent to the inward consolations of the grace of God. And, end quote. And so, you know, the Pope sanctioned these conversion tactics as being biblically acceptable, and he said that God had actually done the same thing with the ancient Israelites in his tolerance of their pagan sacrifices, in his opinion. And so just, I'm saying all that just so that people understand that this was in keeping with the mission of what's called enculturation, the idea that the gospel could take root. This is their idea, that the gospel can take root in local values and in local ideas, and then grow through those local belief systems, and finally reaching the people who hold those belief systems. And so, whether you agree with that idea or not, I'm making this point so that you understand that in a very brief encapsulation, this is how some of these things, like fertility symbols, became associated with modern Easter, because they were allowed to be continued. That belief system was basically adapted into, hybridized into the gospel, and under the hope that the gospel would begin growing up through it. And so now then, you know, both in ancient days and also today, you have, you have Easter eggs, different things that at one time were very important mystical elements of the worship of Volstara and so on, that symbolized birth and fertility, showing up in today's practices of Easter. And by the way, these symbols of fertility, I don't mean to just keep going on and on here, Anita, I'm sorry, but these symbols of fertility weren't just restricted to these Germanic people that I'm referring to. The giving of eggs at spring festivals, that existed among the Persians, among the Romans, among the Jews, among the Armenians. In fact, the ancient Egyptians and the Persians actually colored eggs, just like we do today, and gave them as gifts during their spring festivals. Back to Volstara, the story is told about her that one day she wanted to delight some children. And so she turned her pet bird into a rabbit, and then that rabbit proceeded to begin laying these brightly colored eggs, because, in fact, it was a bird turned into a rabbit, which Volstara then turned around and started giving to these children. So you can see how this, how all of this began to play in. Over in ancient Europe, eggs of various colors went out and collected intentionally. They tried to find these different colored eggs from the nests of just various wild birds out in the forest. And then they used those during their spring festivals to make magical talismans. And then, by the way, those eggs were ritually eaten, which maybe we'll talk about a little bit later. But the search through the woods for these eggs gradually evolved into today's modern Easter egg hunt. And our painted eggs today represent those various colored wild bird's eggs. And one other thing, and then I'll stop because I know you have a lot of questions for me tonight, but Easter baskets originally were intended to resemble the nest, the bird's nest, from which the eggs would be found and retrieved.
Well, that sure explains a lot to me. I've always wondered why a rabbit was, the chosen animal or whatever to toss out these little eggs.
Right.
Very, very clear to me now.
That's where it came from.
Well. Well, I know that you talk about this in your book, The Gods Who Walk Among Us,
mm-hmm.
and you wrote about the history of the spring festivals in that book, and in particular, something about something called Thesmophoria.
Yeah, the Thesmophoria.
Yeah, talk about that for a few moments.
Well, that's in a section of my book, The Gods Who Walk Among Us, in a section called it's in the section where I'm describing the Greek deities, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. Oh, it's in a section called Facts About Demeter. The Demeter was the mystery goddess. I mean, in The Gods Who Walk Among Us, I go into this in great detail in the Thesmophoria, and how that the Thesmophoria was the most popular Greek spring fertility festival of all time, and how it drew the largest crowds ever at Athens and at Eleusis. And by the way, it did so for almost 2,000 years. Now imagine that, because the United States of America is barely over 200 years old. So imagine the largest religious festival in the largest cities of the dominant regions going on for almost 2,000 years. So Demeter, the Thesmophoria's primary goddess, was very important. And in fact, a lot of people have studied what they call the mystery religions. Well, the Demeter's rituals were the most protected cult secrets of the mystery religions in history, as far as I can ascertain. Part of the reason why we don't know a whole lot about what was going on was because her rituals were performed inside the inner sanctum of the Temple of Demeter, what is sometimes called the Telesterion, where her secrets were so well guarded by her temple devotees that really nothing ever made it outside of those doors. And so what we actually know about the Thesmophoria has more to do with those portions of the rituals that were held outside of the temple and that were publicly recorded and therefore provide us with a partial historical record. And of course, being the inquisitive person that I am, that's why I wanted to investigate these fertility rituals of the mystery religions. That's why I included it in my book, The Gods Who Walk Among Us. Now, what's known about the fertility festival of the Thesmophoria is that, first of all, the rituals of the Thesmophoria were based on the mythology of the abduction and rape of Persephone. Now, secondly, Demeter was Persephone's mother, and the myth built around the mystery religion had to do with the abduction and rape of Persephone, and then Demeter's subsequent actions in searching for and trying to find her mother. Now, the reason that's important is because what that means to us is that what we can find in history about these rituals need to therefore be interpreted in the Thesmophoria according to the rape and abduction myth of Persephone, so that we can find what it was supposed to mean, what the value was. All right, very quickly, the myth claim, because I can imagine as I'm talking here, some people might wonder, okay, so what's the myth? The myth claimed that Hades, the dark god of the underworld, had fallen in love with beautiful Persephone. And one day, while she was out picking flowers in a grassy meadow, Hades, he swoops down in this chariot and grabs her, and he drags Persephone down into the underworld where he rapes her and he forces her to become his bride. Now, while that's happening down in the underworld, on the surface of the earth, Demeter is going crazy. She's distraught. Her daughter is missing and she doesn't know where she's at. And so Demeter begins looking all over the earth in vain to try to find her daughter Persephone, and can't find her. Finally, with the help of two other goddesses, Helios and Hecate, Demeter finally discovers, and if I recall this correctly, it's Hecate that discloses to Demeter that it was Hades who had abducted her daughter. So she finally figures out what had happened, and in her fury, she demands that Hades let her daughter go, and Hades refuses. And so Demeter sends this horrific famine upon the earth. Plants begin drying up, seeds won't sprout, nothing is going to grow. And the irony here is that the gods themselves begin to suffer because there's a lack of sacrifices of both food and animals being made to them because there's this terrible famine on earth. And so finally Zeus is dispatched from Olympus. He dispatches Hermes, I should say, as his emissary, to intercede with Hades, the lord of the underworld. And there's this great debate that happens, and anyway, finally, Hades agrees that he's going to release Persephone, but only for a certain time of the year, and only if she would eat a pomegranate seed. Well, what Persephone didn't understand was that by eating this pomegranate seed, in the mystical location of the underworld, it created a sort of divine symmetry that bonded Persephone with Hades, which ensured that the goddess then would automatically have to return to the underworld a third part of each year, of course, which was the winter, during which time the seeds of the ground would not grow. I need you to ask me another question and tell me where I'm at.
Okay, well, some people say these myths were created to explain the changing of the seasons.
Oh, so I was right on target.
Yeah, in other words, the ancients didn't understand the seasons. They saw magic in the dying of the plants, the falling of the seeds, and then the new life or resurrection in the spring when the plants would begin to grow again.
Right, true. Well, okay, that is exactly how Persephone became the spring goddess of youth and happiness and the underworld queen of the dead. This is one of the things you see redundantly sometimes in mythology, is that some of these deities can, on the one hand, be evil, on the other hand, be good. There's this kind of duality, this dual role that depicted Persephone as both good and evil. So on Earth, at a certain time of the year, she's the goddess of the spring and the friend of the nymphs who appear in the blooming of the spring flowers, which symbolize, by the way, her annual return from Hades. But on the other hand, the winter comes, the fall comes, everything starts losing its leaves, everything starts closing up, it's not growing anymore, and the seeds are sprouting, the winter comes, it's harsh. Now, all of a sudden, she's back down in Hades. And in the underworld, she's the dreaded wife of Hades. People were afraid of her. She's the queen of the darkness, the queen of the damned that essentially creates or controls the fates of deceased men. By the way, Nita, you might remember, that's a piece of myth that we included in our novel, The Ahriman Gate. Remember where the bad guys crash their car and Hecate, they die? And but as soon as they die, they're still aware, and Hecate comes out of the oak boughs after them. Remember that?
Yeah.
Nasty stuff, these gods of the underworld. Goddesses of the underworld. Anyway, but now, it is the reenactment of that myth, the abduction and the rape of Persephone, and Demeter's searching for her, that was central to the rituals of the Thesmophoria, and therefore key to interpreting the bits of information that are known. So, with that interpretive key in place, I began looking, when I was writing the book, The Gods Who Walk Among Us, I began looking at the mysteries of the Spring Festival to try to understand, therefore, what it means to us today. Now, this festival of the Thesmophoria is also, for those students out there, it's also sometimes called the Eleusinian Mysteries. And but the Thesmophoria lasted anywhere between 3 to 10 days, depending on where it fell in the year. Each day of the festival had a different name, included different kind of specific rituals. For instance, a highlight of the festival was a procession that was led from Athens to Eleusis, which was led by a crowd of children known as Ephebi. And the Ephebi assisted the adults in carrying what was called the hiera, or the sacred objects, which, by the way, included eggs, Easter eggs. They carried them in their little baskets, and they pulled a statue of Dionysus as a boy called Iakos, and these kids also would assist in the ceremonial cleansing of the initiates, baptism, but these were, of course, candidates of this religion, but they were baptized in the sea. In any case, upon arriving finally at Eleusis, these women would organize the first day of the celebration, which was called a Naos, and they would build these temporary shelters, and they would elect the leaders of the camps, and that would be happening. Then on the second day, which was called Nestia, they would initiate what was called the Greater Mysteries, which, according to myth, would begin producing the cult's magical requests, the magical request primarily being a fertile harvest. These mysteries included a parody of the abduction and the rape of Persephone, including the positioning of these female devotees upon the ground crying in the role of Demeter for her missing daughter. And they would fast for the return of Persephone. That's the myth. What was happening in the real world was they were fasting and praying for the return of spring, the return of fertility. And, by the way, sitting on the ground and fasting was also intended to mystically transfer their energies of these women into the ground and therefore into the fall seeds so that they would sprout and begin growing. And, not surprisingly, the festival was held during the time of the fall planting so as to nearly guarantee a positive response to the cult's magics. Anyway, so different days. The fifth day of the festival, participants would drink of a special grain mixture called kakion, which was a symbol of Persephone, and they would eat these Easter eggs in an attempt to assimilate the spirit of the goddess, the idea being to produce an incarnated blessing of fertility, both of the crops and children. So each day went on like that, until finally the day arrived when these certain women called Aunt Larry were, and I'm not saying Aunt Larry, I'm saying Aunt Larry, A-N-T-L-E-R-I-A-I, were cleansed, and they went down into the sea and were cleansed, and then, and this is the interesting part, we're going to take a commercial break here in a moment, but they were sent down into the trenches of the mountains, the mountainside trenches, where they would recover these sacrificial piglets and these various other sacred objects that had been thrown down into these hillside canyons several days before. Now, these sacred objects included dough replicas of snakes and genitalia and so on, which would be burned later that night with piglets, with the piglets that had been thrown into those mountainside trenches, and also a grain seed mixture, which would be made as an offering to Demeter. Now, this is where it starts getting interesting. And before we go there, we're going to take a short break for a commercial. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, does the Bible have something to say about all this? Mm-hmm. We'll see in a moment.
Okay.
This is the Reality Radio Network on Telstar 5 Transponder 5 and on the internet at realityradionetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Steve from Renaissance Precious Metals. Global financial meltdown, whether you believe it or not, is fully underway. As we head into the winter of discontent, mega corporations are seeking bankruptcy protection to keep their companies alive, but usually at the expense of employees and their retirement funds. Millions of retirees face untold financial hardship as these companies restructure. But I'm telling you today that you can acquire gold and silver and palladium bullion that will provide you with financial life assurance. Precious metals have stood the test of time and will provide you with a storehouse of value and a means of barter when the whole house of financial cards come crashing down. What are you going to do when everyone runs for the financial fire escape and the stock market and U.S. dollar at the same time? Guess what? My goal is to get you outside and out of harm's way before that day comes, while it's still possible. Give me a call at 406-586-4840. That's 406-586-4840, Renaissance Precious Metals, and let me help you acquire not only the peace of mind, but your financial life assurance program.
Including the Pentagon, NASA, Southcom, and Northcom lock onto the Q files the same night Steve Quayle interviewed Tom Horn on his new book, Ahriman Gate. The Ahriman Gate brings the reader face to face with the return of the Nephilim. Dr. Lynn Marzulli, best-selling author of The Nephilim Trilogy. Derek Gilbert from Watcher Magazine says cross Tom Clancy with Frank Moretti and you might get something close to The Ahriman Gate, the new supernatural techno-thriller from husband and wife authors Tom and Nita Horn. In The Ahriman Gate, Tom and Nita Horn, national spokespersons for Cloud 10 Pictures Movie DC, starring Louis Gossett Jr. and Judd Nelson, take you on an incredible journey to out-of-control technology, masquerading demons, and prophetic possibilities in the classic styles of Dean Koontz and John Saul. Learn for yourself why The Ahriman Gate is the number one all-time best-selling novel by VMI Publishers. Endorsed by legendary ufologist Dr. I.D.E. Thomas, as well as over 45 five-star reviews. To order your copy of The Ahriman Gate and for a limited time receive a free gift with every purchase, log on to RaidersNewsUpdate.com. That's www.RaidersNewsUpdate.com. The Ahriman Gate. Some gates should not be opened.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, this is Tom Horn filling in for Steve Quayle, who's going to be back at the helm this Monday night. Appreciate Steve giving us the opportunity to sit in here for him, and we appreciate getting to come into your homes to talk to you about all of the weird and crazy stuff that that we like to talk about over here. That guy that did that commercial just now, he begins by calling The Ahriman Gate a book that I wrote. The truth is, this is a book that you wrote with me, and people need to know that that the best parts of that book came from you and not from me, and we have received so many emails from people talking about the parts of the book they like and the parts of the book that they didn't like. They didn't like some of that nasty, terrible stuff that I put in there with monsters and all that, but boy, they really liked that old man, and they liked the dog, and they like all that, and just so you know, folks, that all came out of my sweet wife's mind.
I could never have done it without you.
Well, anyway, it was fun. We did it together. And, of course, now we're outlining the sequel and some other things. But when we went to the break, and we want to get right back on this because we got a lot of traffic to cover here, I guess, for the end of the show. We were talking about the different days of the Thesmophoria and how the Thesmophoria was the most well-known and certainly the largest of the fertility rituals that took place in ancient history, and I had said when we went to the break, asked the question, does the Bible have anything to say about this? The reason I brought that up is because we were talking about how these pigs and different objects were cast down into these deep mountain trenches, and then several days later, these women named Aunt Larry were cleansed in the sea and sent down into the trenches to these deep trenches to retrieve these sacrificial pigs. They would find the deepest trenches they could. What was happening here? What was all of this symbolically? Now, the reason for the casting of these piglets into the mountainside cliffs, from the Greek perspective, is something that's been debated, and frankly, there has never been a single authoritative interpretation that has emerged as an absolute authority as to why they did that. Several mystical representations could be made of this symbology. Certainly the dough replicas are obviously fertility symbols, and so it goes along with the whole idea of the spring fertility rites. But pig's blood was something that was sacred to the gods, and therefore very important to interpreting the ritual of the Thesmophoria. First of all, remember that in our modern Eastern celebration in some circles, we not only have eggs, rabbits, hot cross buns, and a lot of other things that can be tied back to these fertility rituals, but we also have the traditional Easter ham. And this began, according to some scholars anyway, with the Thesmophoria roasting of the sacrificial piglets of the fertility rituals, because Greeks venerated pigs for several reasons, not the least of which is their uncanny ability to find and to unearth, to unearth things that are under the soil. Do you ever notice that, Nita? You kind of, you kind of grew up on a in a farm atmosphere. Did you ever notice that a pig can find roots and things like that and dig it up from under the ground?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Greeks did too, and so some scholars conclude from this that the ritual casting of these pigs into the deep was a form of imitative magic based on the underworld myth of Persephone and Hades. In other words, casting these piglets into the deep canyon trenches and then fetching them back out again represented the descent of Persephone into the underworld and then her spring return to the surface of the earth. Now, there's another thing. The piglets in the trenches may have accomplished a practical purpose of supplying a host, a body, for Persephone to hide in until the Aunt Larry women could assist her in her annual escape from the underworld by retrieving those piglets from the deep trenches. Later that night, burning these piglets would, according to at least some ancient thinking, free the spirit of Persephone into the upper world. And I know, Anita, that you're familiar with this ancient idea that that a soul can migrate from one dimension to another dimension through the use of fire.
Mm-hmm.
You compare the children in the Bible where it says they were sacrificed to Baal, but what does it say? It says, quote, they passed through the fire. The whole idea being that they went from one physical plane to another physical plane. That's a mystical idea. Now, this is where this starts getting important, so let me make sure I keep moving here. When you think about how the New Testament informs us that pagan rituals, such as those that were performed in the Thesmophoria, were the worship of demons, Paul wrote to the Church of Corinth, and he said, the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils. Now, this makes you wonder if a connection didn't exist between the ritual casting of the piglets into the deep canyon trenches representing a descent into hell and their retrieval back out. If there isn't somehow a connection between that and, guess what, ladies and gentlemen, the biblical story of the Gadarene demoniac. Now, let me explain why I'm saying this. In Luke chapter 8, well, let me just read it to you. Luke chapter 8, starting at verse 26, and I don't want to read all the way through verse 33, so I'll skip a couple of parts, but let me read. And they arrived at the country of the Gadarenes, and when he, that is Jesus, went forth to land, there met him out of the city a certain man which had devils. When he, that is the demoniac, saw Jesus, he cried out, and he fell down before him with a loud voice and said, what have I to do with thee, Jesus? Thou Son of the Most High God, I beseech thee, torment me not. Jump down. And Jesus asked him, saying, what is thy name? And he said, Legion, because many devils were entered into him. And they besought him that he would not command them. Now, catch these next few words. They besought him that he would not command them to go out into the deep. And there was there an herd of swine feeding on the mountain. And they besought him that he would suffer them to enter into them, and he suffered them. Then went the devils out of the man and entered into the swine, and they ran violently down a steep place into the sea and were choked, end quote. Now, the word there in Luke 8, in that text, is where it's talking about the deep. The word deep there is the word abusos, the abyss. It actually is referring to the underworld, bottomless pit, the same thing the Greeks would understand as the abode of Persephone. And I think it's interesting that since the principal elements here of the sea, the swine, the deep, the abyss, that all of these things that were important to the Thesmophoria are also found in this narrative. And then last but not least, of course, the cult rituals of the Thesmophoria were known throughout Asia Minor, and they were considered by the Hebrews to be an activity of the devil. As a matter of fact, the inhabitants of Hades were known by the Hebrews as Demeter's people. And Hecate, the goddess of witchcraft, was Persephone's underworld guide during the rituals. So, given all of that, one could surmise that Jesus potentially might have been mocking the Thesmophoria. He might have been revealing to his followers and to the neighboring communities that these spring festivals were in fact the consort of devils.
Well, we have that in the Old Testament too, where in Exodus all of the plagues that were brought upon the Egyptians were actually a direct judgment to the deities that they served. And so the fact that this has that Jesus, you know, this weekend upcoming, he has victory in all of that. He's doing the same thing in the New Testament as what he did in the Old Testament. And I find that so thrilling. It's just, I love that.
Yeah. Well, that too is something I wrote about in The Gods Who Walk Among Us, how that the Egyptian plagues is an interesting study, in that every one of the plagues, every one of them, can be tied to a repudiation of the power of the various gods that were worshipped by Egypt, in that that one by one, God repudiated and illustrated his authority, his power, over every one of the gods of Egypt. And did you know that I had never thought of the New Testament, a story of Jesus and the Gadarene demoniac? I had never thought of it as Jesus doing in the New Testament the same thing that his father had done in the Old Testament, until you brought that up to me. You were the very first person that brought that up to me, that what God did in the Old Testament in the Exodus, Jesus was doing in the New Testament, illustrating their authority, their power.
Exactly.
Ultimately, no other gods before them. Ultimately, the power. It could be a stretch to interpret this.
Power.
Huh?
And the consistency of that power.
The consistency
of it. Yesterday, today, and forever.
And you and I, of course, have experienced that power personally, so we know this to be more than just a theological segue from one point to another.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing I would say to people is that when they, because we're going so quickly here, and we got about 10 more minutes or so before this show goes off the air tonight, people might look at that Luke chapter 8 and wonder, you know, could this have something to do with the Thesmophoria or not? The point that I would make is that the similarities there, the historical proximities, are startling, especially since the demons requested an entry into these swine, and Jesus gave it to them. Now why would demons make that kind of a plea? There's two possible connections with the Thesmophoria, and that is that the demons believed that by entering the swine, they were going to somehow escape the underworld deep, as in the magical Persephone escape ritual. Demons are not like God. They're not all-knowing. And these were mystical representations that were made. The second thing there, of course, is that Jesus, by granting the request of these devils, may have been, as you said, illustrating that the Thesmophoria ritual casting of the piglets into the deep was inherently demonic. Well, of course, other interpretations of that narrative in Luke chapter 8 carry equal value. But for me, the point is that it's the only record of Jesus granting the petition of demons, and therefore it seems possible that a powerful social commentary on a popular pagan idea like the Thesmophoria of Demeter, which was numero uno, the biggest mystery religion, fertility ritual ever, that something was being said of Jesus about the nature of that ritual.
Okay, well, let's hone in on this for a minute.
Okay.
So what does this mean, then, for Christians during this Easter weekend?
Should we not recognize this season? Go ahead.
Should we not recognize this season?
Well, your question, what does it mean to Christians? I think it means different things to different Christians. In other words, I think some Christians will find it difficult to reconcile celebrating the resurrection of Christ with also, at the same time, co-opting these fertility parallels. I also understand that some people believe that when Christians attend Easter sunrise services, they're celebrating the meaning of the resurrection of Christ. I mean, ancient spring goddesses are the last thing on their mind. I also know that some people would say that even if the word Easter originated with pagan goddesses, that they're not forbidden to exalt the Lord on any day of the week, including Easter Sunday, and some people think that that would be silly, because if you want to become too hardline about this, every day of the week is connected to some pagan deity. I mean, Monday is Moon's Day, Tuesday is Tuesday's Day, Wednesday is Woden's Day, Thursday is Thor's Day, and so on. Therefore, you know, to some people, Easter Sunday is like any other day of the week. It's a day to worship Christ.
So then what is the message of Easter? What is the message of Easter?
What is the message of Easter?
Mm-hmm.
Look, here's the deal. To me, the message of this week is no different than any other week. The message is, number one, a man died. Number two, a man was buried. And number three, a man rose from the dead on the third day. That's the gospel of God. And it's good 365 days a year. It's a message that spans the halls of time. It's a message that can't be contained
mm-hmm.
by a particular season or a particular time. It's the story. Look, it's the story of every book of the Bible. The story of a man sent by God to give us resurrection life and hope beyond the grave.
Yeah.
It's told in Genesis, where we see the seed that's going to bruise the serpent's head. It's told in Exodus, in the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. It's in Leviticus and Numbers, where he's the high priest making intercession for his people in the Holy of Holies. It's in Deuteronomy, where he's the bearing up in everlasting arms. It's in Joshua, where he's the captain of the host of the Lord. It's in Judges, where he's the sword of the Lord for Gideon. It's in Ruth, where he's the perfect groom that takes to himself the perfect bride. It's in 1 and 2 Samuel, where he's the voice that calls a small boy to the priesthood and a shepherd boy to the throne of Israel. It's in 1 and 2 Kings, where he's the mantle of Elijah and the chariot of the Lord our God. It's in 1 and 2 Chronicles, where he's the Shekinah, or to use a more modern way of saying that word, like Bush did in our invasion of Iraq, he's the Shekinah. He's the glory of God filling the Temple of Solomon. In Ezra and Nehemiah, he's the voice that calls his people to rise up and rebuild in troubled times. In Esther, he's actually the queenly figure, making intercession for the people that she loves. Then in Job, he's the Lord that's going to stand on the earth in the last day. In Psalms, he's the good shepherd that leads beside the still waters, who restores our soul. In Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, he's the wise instruction of a father to his son. In the Song of Solomon, he's the lily of the valley, the rose of Sharon, the fairest of them all. Then in Isaiah, he's the lamb wounded for our transgressions and bruised for our iniquities. In Jeremiah and Lamentations, he's the Lord patiently calling to the backslider. In Ezekiel, guess what, you ufologist? He's the wheel in the middle of the wheel and the resurrection power in the valley of dry bones. In Daniel, he's the rock cut out without hands that grows to inhabit the whole earth. In Hosea and Joel, he's the rain of the latter days and the restoration. Hopefully, I'm looking forward to this day. He's the restoration of a mighty church. In Amos, Obadiah, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, he's the last voice of the prophets in prophesying that soon a child is going to be born who's going to bruise the head of the serpent and rule the world in peace. Then finally, in Matthew, he arrives. A babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger, the lion of the tribe of Judah. In Mark, he's the great physician. In John, he's the word made flesh and dwelling among us. In Acts, he's the giver of the power of Pentecost. In Romans, he's the only fulfillment of the law. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. Capable of freeing you forever from the guilt and condemnation of the law. In Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Thessalonians, he's the perfect doctrine of the church of the Lord Jesus Christ and the power that fills men, against which the powers of hell cannot prevail. In Titus, in Philemon, he's the dedication of young men that have given themselves over to a lifetime of service to a king. In Hebrews, he is our heavenly high priest, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. In James, Peter, John, and Jude, he's the harnessing of a power greater than nuclear energy. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the resurrection power, the Easter power, but we don't have to use that word, the resurrection power of pure love. And then finally, in Revelations, he is the Lamb of God, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He's the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the object of the praise of the redeemed throughout all of eternity, the Son of the Almighty God, seated forever at the right hand of God in power and majesty. He is the head of the church. He's the soon-coming ruler of planet Earth, whether people like it or not. He's the only rightful heir and the only true potentate. I'm talking about Jesus, before who the nations of the world are going to be gathered at a future time of, guess what? Resurrection. And certainly, he is the reason for the season. That's what they say. He's a reason for every season, not just this season, but every season. So, what is the message of Easter? Look, if it bothers you that there are these antiquated relationships, don't practice them. And don't practice Easter if you don't want to. But if you do practice Easter or any other day of the week or any other day of the year, the important thing is Christ. Christ is the important thing. I got to preaching, didn't I?
It's the message of hope.
Sorry about that, Nita. Did you start crying?
There's so much to it. There's more to it. It's just awesome.
Sorry. Somewhere around Exodus, I thought, now I've started down this road. I got to keep going.
No, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Here, folks. Here it is. Matthew 28. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning and his raiment white as snow. For fear of him, the keepers did shake and became as dead men. And the angel answered and said to the women, "Fear not, ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus which was crucified, but he's not here. He has risen, and he has said, come see the place where the Lord lay." Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on the Q-Files. Join us again tomorrow night. We're going to be talking to Randy Harrigan.
We would like to thank you for tuning in today to the Q-Files. If you want more information and would like to contact Steve Quayle, you can reach Steve at 406-586-4840. Again, you can reach Steve Quayle at 406-586-4840. His mailing address is The Q Files, 315 Edelweiss Drive, Bozeman, Montana, 59718. Again, you can reach Steve at The Q Files, 315 Edelweiss Drive, Bozeman, Montana, 59718.